Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Three Sides to Every Adoption. I'm Sarah Easterly. I'm an adoptee, and I'm joined by Kelsey Vandervliet Renyard, a birth mom, Lori Holden, an adoptive parent, and we have a special guest today, Catherine Joyce. Welcome, Catherine. We're so glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a real honor. So, Catherine is an investigative reporter at Salon. She's also the author of two books, The Child Catchers, Rescue Trafficking, and The New Gospel of Adoption, and Quiverful Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. Catherine, you've reported for all kinds of different publications, esteemed ones, The Marshall Project, Mother Jones, Vanity Fair, New York Times Magazine, Wired, Vox, New York Times Sunday Review. The list goes on and on. You're quite distinguished, quite a resume, and we're just really honored that you took the time today to talk with us about this really important topic. I feel like I should probably give a little bit of a trigger warning just because I think this is one of, I think out, so far it's going to be kind of the hardest topic that we've covered in adoption, real directly. And it might be really hard, especially maybe for adoptive parents listening. I think we thank you for listening and we appreciate that you're listening. And you might need to do it in small doses, but we do ask that you do listen. It's important. Information to know about the adoption industry and some of the darker things that often aren't exposed and aren't brought to the forefront of our consciousness. So, yeah, I guess, and for adoptees too, take care of yourself and birth parents watching. I think just take care of yourself wherever you are at in the constellation and how you're approaching this material. But thank you for approaching it. Okay, so. Child Catchers. This book, Catherine, is so rich. So much research went into this. I can't even imagine. I refer to it so often. I tell so many people to read this book. I reread it for different information all the time. And I just was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about the Child Catchers and how you came to write it and what you found.
Sure. And thank you so much. That means an awful lot. Gosh, the Child Catchers, it came out, it's getting close to 10 years ago. It came out in 2013. And I guess I started working on this topic. Really, I guess my interest started being piqued around 2007, 2008. And I think it was 2009 that I probably published my first story on it. Which was in The Nation. I wrote for so many places because I was a freelancer forever. And so that's just kind of have gun, will travel as an occupation. But that first piece that I wrote for The Nation, I was looking at particularly the role of crisis pregnancy centers in adoption. I had stumbled upon a few things that made me interested to see, how these centers, which are already, of course, primarily anti-abortion or pro-life, how they were intersecting with the adoption industry. And there were a few, in the mid-aughts, there were a few different reports that came out for and by crisis pregnancy center networks trying to sort of increase their, I guess, efficiency or their success rates in not just counseling women out of having an abortion, but then a second step, urging them to choose adoption instead of parenting as well. And so I was looking at that and was fairly taken aback by some of the things I was finding. One of the reports that I was looking at that time was literally called Birth Mother, Good Mother. And so it was just kind of drawing this equation that for a certain group of people, the way to be a good mother is to be a birth mother, is to relinquish your child for adoption. So that piqued my interest as well. But then as I was reporting, I sort of fell down this rabbit hole. I started speaking to a lot of mothers from the baby scoop era, mothers who had relinquished for adoption, from the 50s, up through the 80s. In some cases, I guess that the baby scoop era is typically seen as having ended in, the early 70s. But I was just hearing these stories of these women, a lot of whom had been sent away to maternity homes, had experienced, at least in many cases, pretty severe coercion. In some cases, I think it crossed the line into something that maybe is closer to force, that they were not really given a chance to decide for themselves whether or not relinquishment was something that they wanted to do. And I guess I just, as I was reading that, I remember I spoke with Anne Fessler, who wrote this amazing book, The Girls Who Went Away, this oral history of that era. And I just had this kind of stunned reaction, like, why don't I know this as a part of women's history, as, a part of human rights history? And obviously much of that is on me, but as I kind of undertook to learn more, it just seemed like this issue that, endlessly was sort of opening new doors, like it touched so many things that I think we all care about, women's rights, civil rights, racial justice, children's rights, parents' rights. It just seemed, the legacy of colonialism, particularly when we're talking about international adoption, but it just seemed like there was so much there. There was such a complicated history. And I just wanted to understand more.
Thank you for understanding and taking a look. And you're not in the adoption constellation at all, right?
Yourself? No, I'm not personally. I do have family members who have relinquished for adoption in the past. But that, was not that was extended family. It was not a large part of, my understanding at any point, really.
I finally got around to reading your book. It had been on my to be read list for so long. And I finally was prompted by what's going on in Ukraine right now. And one of the parts that really helped me understand it was where you talked about the cycle. And I was wondering if you could share about the cycle that happens in a country that's undergoing some kind of dramatic tragedy.
Sure. So I opened the book, obviously, as I was just saying, I started off looking primarily at domestic adoption, and then pretty quickly came to realize, like, oh boy, this world is so much bigger. There's so much more going on internationally as well. And also, it wasn't long after I started looking at adoption as a subject in general that the terrible earthquake in 2010 happened in Haiti. Just this, really cataclysmic natural disaster. And as I was paying attention to adoption, and also just like so many other people, just reading the news about what was going on there, because it was, just the level of devastation was just so tremendous. I just noticed how much of the coverage from US news sources in particular was focused on adoption. That adoption was almost becoming, if not quite the primary story about the Haiti earthquake, for American readers, at least it was becoming, at least a second or third level story. Just all of these articles and news broadcasts and later documentary specials kind of talking about how there was this silver lining to this terrible earthquake that absolutely devastated the capital of Haiti. And the silver lining was that, all of these children who had perhaps been stuck in the adoption pipeline were now having a chance to have their cases be expedited and come to the United States. And I think, in some of those cases, that expediting was, finalizing some adoptions that were actually pretty close to completion. But then that category sort of seemed to expand as there was just all of this you know, American middle class and, you know, higher interest in, you know, what's happening to the children there, which we can understand. But that sort of started being translated into demands on the US government, on the Haitian government, on international aid organizations, that we really have to expand this category of kids who we are, you know, using an expedited process to get them out of the country. So, you know, a process called humanitarian parole was enacted in the US to streamline that process, primarily at first for kids who were very near to, you know, finalizing their adoptions. But then there was just this pressure to open that up further and further. And, you know, kids started, you know, showing up at the airport, not by themselves, but, you know, brought by, you know, usually Western, usually US orphanage staff, people associated with adoption agencies, also just like kind of a lot of random do-gooders who went down to Haiti and wanted to do something to help. And the thing that's stood out to them is this is the way we can help, is we can get these kids out of the country. And, you know, I think there was a lot of good intentions behind a lot of that. But then we get into, you know, the questions that bedevil a lot of adoption history, which is that, you know, whose kids are these? Are these kids, you know, actually orphans, or are they, you know, are they kids whose parents are missing, but want to find them? Are they kids whose, you know, parents were before the earthquake encountering some sort of family crisis or hard time that they put their kids in the orphanage as, you know, intending it to be a temporary stay during a time of family crisis, but they were visiting their kids, they intended to bring them home, which is really the case in a lot of, you know, orphanage settings around the world. You know, UNICEF has said that overwhelmingly kids in institutional care around the world have at least one parent, or at least if not that, then they have extended family who are caring for them. You know, obviously there are still a number of children who do not have any close family members who are taking care of them. But the statistics that we see around the so-called orphan crisis are just really, perhaps with good intentions, but are just really misrepresenting the situation as it stands. And so, you know, that happened in Haiti, but it's also this cycle, as you said, Lori, that just has happened repeatedly. It happened after the terrible tsunami in the Indian Ocean back in 2004, kind of on the cusp of 2005. It happened, you know, in war zones, in you know, in different countries around the world. You know, sometimes with claims that children were war orphans who actually were not. And I think we have also started to see the potential for this, if not, you know, necessarily yet the realization, when it comes to the war in Ukraine. You know, there have been a number of calls for, you know, addressing this crisis. You know, there are more than 10 million people from Ukraine who are displaced, and, you know, a number of them are children. A number of them are children who had been in institutional care. And so a lot of this kind of came to the forefront, you know, in recent weeks as well. But sorry if I'm getting ahead of us there.
No, that's fine. So it starts with really good intentions. We want to help people. And then what happens? What's the rest of that cycle?
Yeah, well, this is not really my original insight. You know, I know E.J. Graff wrote about this. I know other scholars and journalists and just members of the triad have written about, you know, these issues as well. But, you know, there is this cycle that, you know, it feels so offensive to talk about it in economic terms, but it is an economic cycle. There is a boom bust cycle that has happened in international adoption for many years. So there is sort of a boom in one adoption sending country, is, you know, the terminology, as you all know, and I probably most of your viewers know as well. But it becomes kind of the hotspot country of the moment. And then all of this attention and all of this Western money floods into this country, to meet a new demand, usually among Western prospective adoptive parents who are hoping to adapt from this country. And, you know, some of that is setting up necessary infrastructure. Some of it is doing good works. A lot of it is also being spread around to various middlemen, whether or not that's people who are working directly as adoption facilitators, kind of helping identify children who might be available for adoption. Or sometimes we have seen basically recruiting children from intact families with misleading premises, like that your child will go to the US and get a great education and then come back. But also, I mean, I think, you know, it supports all of these sort of ancillary industries as well. If in Ethiopia, when Ethiopia became an extremely high demand and kind of high volume international adoption sending country, you know, then suddenly there are all of these services that pop up to, you know, meet the demand of prospective adoptive parents who are coming into the country to stay for a while, to meet their children, to go through the process, to, you know, in some countries to meet, you know, various residency requirements. So then there's translators, there are kind of fixers, there are hotels, there are drivers, there's, you know, restaurants, all of this stuff starts to kind of orbit around this kind of artificial industry. So, you know, Western money just flooding into these countries can have this really sort of distorting effect on, you know, what might be going on there elsewhere. And also I think E.J. Graff has written about this as well, that, you know, there is this sort of trend of the hotspot country hopping from kind of one place to another, in response to like whatever is going on in adoption in that country at the time. So before Ethiopia was the big sending country, it was Guatemala. And Guatemala at one point was sending just tremendous numbers of children to adoption in the US. I think if I try to remember the statistic offhand, I might get it wrong. At one point there was kind of a stunning ratio of like, you know, for every, you know, number of children who are born in Guatemala, X number are going to the US. That started off with legitimate need. There were children in Guatemala who were in need of adoptive homes. But then as this sort of caught on in the US, as this became a more popular adoption program, the demand just really sort of outpaced the supply. Again, I know these are dehumanizing terms, but it does function as an industry. And you know, not necessarily the supply of children in need of homes, but the supply of children who met kind of the criteria of what, you know, the demand was here in the United States. And so that led to a pattern of abuses in Guatemala, as it has in other countries, where there started to be recruitment of people to send their children overseas for adoption, sometimes with misleading promises. There started to be stories of coercion. There even, in some rare but awful cases, started to be cases of alleged kidnapping. And Aaron Siegel McIntyre has kind of written the definitive book on that, Finding Fernanda, which is told, I guess it's told from two sides of the adoption story, because the child that in question in this story was too young to really participate. But, you know, in that case, there actually was, a bona fide kidnapping and an adoptive parent in the US who, you know, noticed some things seemed off, became suspicious, you know, started digging in, ended up ultimately kind of finding out this truth, you know, about, you know, the family in Guatemala that had not agreed. So, I mean, that I think is also something that we see is a lot of times, attention to these issues is being raised by all sides of the triad, including by adoptive parents who have noticed you know, something seems off with my agency, something is off with the story that they're telling me. But that cycle just kind of repeats itself and repeats itself. When Guatemala ended up closing its adoption program in response to some of these stories, a lot of the adoption agencies that were working there just sort of picked up and moved to Ethiopia. When there was a much larger demand to adopt from Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake than could be, you know, ethically, legally, or just kind of realistically met, a lot of those adoption agencies would, you know, direct people, well, can you look at our Ethiopia adoption program instead? Because this is something that's ongoing, even as, you know, you're not going to be successful in trying to adopt from Haiti right now.
Catherine, you also talk in your book about Korean adoptions, kind of almost as the baseline for how international adoption evolved. Can we talk about Korea a little bit as well? There's so many Korean adoptees affected in similar ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, I did not have the chance to go to South Korea for my reporting in that. And I was just really standing on the shoulders of so many researchers, a lot of whom are adoptees from Korea, or are, you know, within the Korean diaspora, who have just been kind of researching and writing about this for a long time. But yeah, that was really interesting. I mean, in a way, you know, international adoption as a broad program, not just sort of an isolated thing that would happen here or there, really emerged out of the Korean War. The Holt family, that ended up starting the, you know, massive, longstanding and well-respected adoption agency Holt that we're all aware of, that started with, you know, this couple from the Pacific Northwest who, you know, became interested in the idea that there were these sort of war orphans. A lot of times, biracial children born of a Korean mother and a US or, you know, sometimes I guess European father, and were facing discrimination within their society for that association and were not being accepted. So the international adoption just sort of field from Korea started, you know, focused a lot on those children, kind of quickly grew to encompass a number of other children, and really was, I wrote in my book an awful lot about the evangelical adoption movement that was prominent in the aughts and early 2010s. I think it's, you know, very much changed shape today, and we could talk about that more if you'd like. But this, you know, what happened in Korea was really a forerunner to that. The Holts were intensely devout. They wrote multiple books about international adoption and about what they saw as this mission, that were, you know, all using parts of scripture as their titles. And it really launched international adoption as a field. And as what many people saw as a calling. And because of that, I think a lot of Korean adoptees ended up being the first generation in many cases, or kind of as a block, you know, not obviously not speaking to every individual person, but they were, you know, this generation that started coming of age as the first, you know, block of adult adoptees who, you know, wanted to say, you know, hey, there's, we have this whole side to this story that just does not get told. I think the title of your program is brilliant. That there are three sides to every adoption. That it reflects that for so long, we've only ever heard, you know, usually one, sometimes maybe two of those. There's often been a perspective left out, whether it's the side of the first family or the adoptees. And I think that, you know, that generation did so much to just kind of make a mark and say, you know, we have to be listening to the perspective of adoptees as well.
Catherine, I know we mentioned earlier, like the good intentions and the do-gooders that go overseas or wherever they're going to these other countries and setting up their shingle and trying to run a business. I think that when I read your book, and you know, I work in domestic adoption. I've worked in it for 5 years. And these practices that we read about in your book, are they just like are reminiscent of the Dr. Hicks cases and the Georgia Tan cases, and in a not so slightly milder sense, the entirety of the baby scoop era? And while domestic adoption, we have many, many issues, and we have like so many flaws in domestic adoption, but we seem to have a little better handle on it now versus back in baby scoop. And what, if you could pinpoint like the root of the cause of these bad practices and why people choose to go over there and do what they do, even with good intentions, what would you pin that on, I guess, in your opinion?
Like bad actors among adoption agencies who are behaving unethically overseas?
Yeah. Specifically, yeah, with international, like what, if you could, whether it's, you know, white saviorism or if it's evangelical Christianity or any number of things that you could pin it on. I realize that there's a lot of different factors. What is the thing that you saw most often?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different agencies, or, you know, there were, I mean, international adoption has constricted so greatly in the last 10 years, and a number of agencies, you know, have shifted gears, some have closed. So, I mean, it is hard to kind of, to speak, you know, just as a block. You know, I think some of the things you mentioned, you know, they definitely strike me as important parts. You know, I think, you know, a lot of times adoption agencies in the past at least have, you know, used a lot of savior type language. And, you know, I think I wrote a lot about evangelical Christians and that movement in the book. I also, you know, and there are definitely unique things to that movement. I also think a lot of the issues are kind of more broadly applicable in some cases, but the Christian adoption movement, you know, definitely made some of that language just really widespread, really, really kind of overt, not subtext, but text, and just kind of in hoping, I think with really good intentions, to turn international adoption especially into a mass movement. You know, they were popularizing you know, a lot of ways of looking at adoption that I think are, you know, to use like really academic jargon, like need to be problematized, but, you know, like talking about the need to rescue, of course, but then just kind of referring to a huge mass of children as orphans does something on its own. You know, when I was reporting and trying to understand the language around the so-called orphan crisis, you know, back, and this is back 10 years ago, as that was getting, you know, really popularized around the time of the Haiti earthquake and in its aftermath, you know, this sort of constant drumbeat message that there is an orphan crisis in which, you know, there are, you know, 143 million, or later it became 163 million or 210 million orphans around the world, but there are X number of Christians. And if we all just, you know, open our homes and our hearts, we can solve this crisis forever. You know, for one, it's painting with a pretty broad brush, with to label children who are in a wide variety of situations as though they are all orphans in the way that we in the U.S. understand that term. In the U.S., if we had a friend whose spouse died, and you know they had you know they were left raising those children, we probably would not refer to those children as orphans. You know, we would just say they're bereaved. They're part of a bereaved family. But a lot of the kids around the world who have been labeled as orphans are in exactly that situation. And you know, there's something that is preventing us from, I think, seeing the full humanity of that family when we refer to those kids as orphans as well. You know, it also just became, I don't know, such a mass movement that people started talking about it in kind of just, I don't know, increasingly exaggerated terms. People would pick up on that language that there were 143 million orphans around the world in need of adoption. Mm-hmm. And they just start using numbers that factually don't make sense, you know, saying, you know, there's a million new orphans every X number of days or something that's just not practically possible, saying that a full tenth of Haiti's population is comprised of orphans. That's not practically possible. But when you're turning something into a mass movement, you could see how just everyday normal people, they sort of slip into these exaggerated modes of thinking, which is understandable. I misspeak all the time, absolutely. But I mean, I think it speaks to this deeper thing that was going on, which is not really looking at this situation through a realistic focus. And also then started to see, you know, one of the things I read that stuck out to me the most at the time was just reading an awful lot of, you know, blogs and newsletters and websites that people were creating around adoption. And people were starting to use the term birth mother in an equally loose way. You know, so they would, people who are interested in adopting, in one case, at least, I'm remembering a particular story. This particular blogger started writing about, you know, how her baby was out there, you know, and her sense, her, you know, the sense of her faith that, you know, God has, you know, selected this child who is meant to be her child. But then she kind of starts like, you know, writing just in a, you know, a fantasy way about how, you know, what is going to happen to bring this child to her. And, you know, so it's, you know, that there is a mother out there who is pregnant and, you know, either, you know, she is going to end up, you know, prematurely dying or something kind of terrible is going to happen that is going to necessitate, you know, her being separated from this child. But then you're also like, you're talking about, you know, it's just so many hypotheticals kind of cool. Layered upon each
cool thing to dream about.
I mean, I don't mean to make it sound more ghoulish than it is, but I think it was just this idea that you are labeling, you know, an unborn hypothetical child as an orphan. It's just a way that, you know, it just kind of, I don't know, it's a sort of literal way of, you know, the invisibilizing of the family of that kid.
And growing up in the evangelical church, like, it's not, for me, it's not hard to see how people got from point A to point B. I grew up in the missionary church, which is like a small denomination in the Rust Belt. And okay. They're based on missionary work. And sure. We would have a missionary come in like every month to church and talk to us. And so when these things were going on, when what you were writing about, I was a kid. And so I remember, like, as I was reading your book, I'm like remembering these services and the language and the big ask at the end of the service and
sure.
How we were rescuing orphans. And I remember those things being talked about. And it was crazy to me to sit there and read your book and be like, no, this is all very plausible because this, I was like sitting in the pew listening to these messages. And of course, I didn't know when I was 10 years old that 12 years later, I'd become a birth mother myself and my whole world would be flipped upside down. But yeah, it was just, it's always an interesting path to look back on my time in the church pre-placement and post-placement.
I bet.
Because it's, and how they speak about international adoptions as well, because I think the way people speak about it is really like this birth family is like invisible or like ghost-like or they just don't exist. Yeah. And so it's really interesting to see they just live in a different country. They're not like it's not like they this baby came out of nowhere, but it's interesting. So
that's fascinating, Kelsey. Thanks.
As I'm listening to you, Catherine, I'm seeing that there's almost like a mission creep with going into a country that is having a crisis. It starts out by wanting to help people get out of crisis, but the mission starts to expand. And it feels like there's an underlying and unexamined belief that people may have that they don't know they have, which would be something like, our way is better. Those kids would be better here anyway, because our way is better. And you know, I've lived in a couple of different other countries and the people there were very kind to me as American, but they didn't want to be American. They love their country. People tend to love their fatherland or their motherland. And so that belief that we can do it better with our religion, we can do it better with our economy, that kind of creeps in and clouds the ethical issues. Does that seem to fit with what you're saying?
I think that's a great way to look at it. Mission creep. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, so many times my understanding is that, you know, countries became sort of the next sort of destination or the next hotspot or the next kind of big sending country, because initially there was a need, you know, sometimes associated with, you know, some particular event, you know, whether it's there is sometimes a disaster or sometimes a conflict that has led to a lot of, you know, separation or instability. But then, you know, I think it's, there's sort of this momentum of, you know, when something becomes an industry that, you know, it stops addressing kind of just that one kind of discrete need. It starts kind of growing. And remember when I was reporting in Ethiopia, I spoke with somebody who worked on this issue with UNICEF, and he sort of described it as like, kind of think of it almost like Field of Dreams, like if you build it, they will come. Like if you build an orphanage, it's going to be filled with children, and not necessarily because those are orphaned kids. A lot of times because that orphanage, you know, in many countries where, you know, there is not access to free education, the orphanage is the place where you can send your kids to school, or they can, you know, at least they can get some kind of education for free. You know, if there is kind of a period of scarcity for one reason or another, an orphanage is a place where some of your kids can, you know, be fed for a while, take some strain off, you know, the rest of, you know, the need to feed the whole family. You know, but there are all of these reasons why orphanages kind of, they, if they're built, they will end up getting filled with kids. But it is not necessarily kind of a reflection of like, wow, there is now this, you know, hundredfold increase of orphans in this area. It's, you know, it's kind of a response to these more complex kind of human situations. Somebody else I spoke to from UNICEF, who actually became fairly demonized during the whole Haitian earthquake, Susan Bissell, she became just kind of the poster woman for a number of people that, you know, she was seen as blocking international adoption. So I don't think she really was, but she pointed out, you know, that when we talk about an orphan crisis, we're talking about a crisis of poverty, You know, sometimes we're talking about, you know, a crisis of conflict, you know, an instability crisis, that there are just these broader things going on. And, you know, if we just kind of want to deal with that, like by focusing only on the children, we're missing this bigger picture.
One thing that I was just thinking about while we were talking about just the evangelical angle to this, because I too grew up in the church. I still, I identify as Christian. However, church is really complicated. And I will say, I almost can't walk into a setting with other Christians without having an adoptive parent or two, at least in the room, even if it's a small group of 10 people. And many of them who've adopted internationally or domestically, but most internationally. And what I often hear is just, as soon as the word is out that I'm an adoptee, is such a beautiful thing. And just this, it's, I wonder how much of this is this inability to sit with, is it at odds with terrible things are happening in the world? And it's really hard to make sense of that spiritually, that a loving God, this loving God we know of and we speak of, allows these tragedies to happen. And so it's an easy way out. It's almost playing God to do this rescuing and seeing adoption only as this beautiful, happy thing, and looking away of here we go, we're going to save, and we're going to go into the saving and the rescuing. I don't know, I really almost cannot walk into those spaces without being told how beautiful adoption and it is. And it's really hard to sit with that especially when I know your work and I know the situations of corruption. And my own adoption came out of a situation of coercion in the baby scoop era. And when you know what really goes on, it's hard to see it as this beautiful thing. It certainly can end up that way. And I had a beautiful adoption story myself, but it also comes from loss and hardship almost always. And it feels like this kind of inability in the evangelical settings to look at, to be able to sit with that, that there is pain and there are just some things that just aren't good in the world. I don't know. I don't know what your perspective would be on that, Catherine.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting to hear. I just to affirm everything you said, that all sounds, you know, very much like situations I've heard about a lot of times. You know, I will also say in fairness that, you know, as I was reporting, you know, a lot of the people who became sources, to use a journalism term, who spoke to me, who shared their stories, or who shared tips, said, you know, I think this thing is going on here. An awful lot of them were adoptive parents from all sorts of backgrounds, but certainly including evangelical Christian backgrounds as well. And I think, you know, a lot of adoptive parents, I think, you know, because they felt so strongly about their family, about their children, you know, were horrified sometimes if they learned that something like that, some sort of corruption or coercion had been a part of, you know, the story of how their family came together, you know, or they just, you know, they were invested enough in the issue because this was how their family was created, to really kind of be alert about all of the other context that was going on outside. So, you know, I just want to, you know, I guess credit people who, you know, have been having those harder conversations for a while. And the movement as a whole, I think, also has, not because of my book, but just probably more because, frankly, of the constriction in the international adoption numbers overall, the movement has shifted focuses. You know, I think that there is more emphasis within you know, what used to be kind of, I used to call more the Christian adoption movement, now I think has shifted more towards being a movement that includes a focus on, you know, different sorts of alternatives, family preservation, sometimes, you know, when we're talking internationally, in-country foster care options, as well as domestic adoption in, you know, in countries that used to be big adoption sending countries. So I think that there has been, you know, some grappling with these sorts of issues at a movement level. Though at the same time, I think, you know, not to presume anybody's political positions on anything, but as we are seeing different developments in the United States, whether about, you know, the very real possibility that, you know, Roe versus Wade may be overturned, or kind of abortion may be effectively outlawed in a lot of places, I think we are starting to see, you know, an increasing focus on, you know, either at the legislative level or just kind of in the way people are talking about this at the movement level, about how, like, we need to start promoting adoption as the response to this situation. And I do think, you know, that is something that people should be concerned about, regardless of how they feel about, you know, what may happen this June with regards to abortion. You know, there are people who are already talking about basically setting up more maternity homes, more kind of crisis pregnancy center hotlines that have connections to adoption. So I think, you know, there is the potential for repeating some bad old history if we're not kind of very cautious and alert to what's going on. Sorry, I think I strayed a little bit from your question there.
I want to tie the two things together, because I think you're right, Catherine, that it's probably a simplistic model to think that a large percentage of abortions will turn into adoptions. That might be a little bit of wishful thinking, and it's simple. And tying this into what you said, Sarah, I think you are spot on, that we live in such a complex world now. So we're always intuitively thinking of ways to simplify things. And binary is simple. It's a shortcut for everything that we don't have to think about. So whenever we get into a place with a lot of emotion or fervor or zeal, whether that's religion or politics, we have shortcuts where we don't have to think about the nuances and dive into the complexity and come up with different guidelines for different situations. So it does make everything simple, but it also means that we shut down our opportunities for critical thinking and things. So I think that's kind of what could be going on with Ukraine and adoption. It could be going on with what's going to happen with the Supreme Court. And we've said this before on our episode, Sarah, that adoption is complex. Nothing about this is binary at all.
Yeah. And I do think people have really good intentions. I mean, I think for the most part, most people do have good intentions. I think, I think of those watching who maybe are not familiar with this darker side of adoption as an industry. What's our message for? What is our message collectively for them? You know, if you've already adopted and you're dialing back, I mean, you know, I'm just trying to put myself in those shoes of what do you do? What do you do with this information? And I don't know if I have that answer other than open your eyes, you know, and look and try to see all of humanity and honor that and learn from history, like you were saying, Catherine, in these situations going forward. It's complex. It's really hard.
What you both were just saying reminds me, and I'm afraid I'm going to butcher the quote a little bit. Do you know Amy Seek's book, God and Jetfire? There's this just really this line that I don't know, has never quite left my head since reading it. And for viewers who might not have read it, it's a beautiful book and you should, but it's this memoir of a birth mother, a first mother who has she enters an open adoption that seems like it's sort of, you know, like the platonic ideal of an open adoption in some ways, like everybody's got really good intentions. Everybody's trying to bring their best self to the table. And yet it's still just incredibly hard, at times incredibly painful. Also, you know, she writes at times very beautiful, very complex, but she has this line where she talks about, you know, kind of just, I don't know, trying to figure out the complexities of this situations. It's something like the animal complexities of what we have done. And she's sort of acknowledging that, like, we're dealing with something. When we're talking about adoption, you're dealing with something. I think when she says animal, I mean, I just read that as like the most kind of basic biological facts of life are being complicated in some way or another. And, you know, even in that situation that she's writing about, where like really everybody is kind of working from, you know, being their best selves, and like it's a pretty ideal situation, it's still like so damn hard. And I don't know, yeah, I just think that what you were saying about how complex it is made me think of that. But I think, you know, also what you were saying, but what both of you were saying, like shutting your eyes to those complexities can't be the answer, because that's what, you know, that is what so much of the history of this issue has been based on, is, you know, in the baby scoop era, sending people away, out of sight, out of mind, go deal with your embarrassing problem and come back, and we'll just kind of proceed with life as though none of that happened. And obviously that wasn't possible, you know, really for anyone in the triad, in those affected relationships. You can't, you know, shove it out of sight, out of mind, as we are seeing all of these successive waves of generations of adoptees become, you know, teenagers and adults and start, you know, speaking in their own voice, you know, about their experiences. You know, they are not going to be content to have their voices be excluded from the conversation, of course, and nor should they be. So I think, yeah, I mean, we just have to pay attention to all of those voices.
Well, I mean, I feel like we could keep going and going, Catherine. I'm just so thankful that you took the time to talk with us today about this issue. And I do, I feel like we could have you back a few more times, because, you know, there's so much to dive into that you do, but I do highly recommend your book to everybody. We'll put this in the show notes. We'll put the link to your Salon article about the situation.
Thank you.
Ukraine as well. And then the other references that you touched on, The Girls Who Went Away, and Amy Seek's book, God and Jetfire. We're big fans of Amy Seek and have a connection to her. So we're planning to have her on a future episode as well. Yeah, thank you. Just thank you for this conversation. It's and thanks to everybody who's stayed with us. It's a hard one, but a really important one, just so that we can learn and think critically and honor everyone as best as we possibly can in a world that isn't always this happy rainbows. You know, it's a world with tragedy, and people who want to help, and then there's people who take advantage of that and can you know, turn it into situations that aren't ultimately necessarily in the best interest of families. So thank you for the time and for listening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Catherine.